This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Dr. Scott Acton is a wavefront scientist for Ball Aerospace and spent decades of his life working on the James Webb Space Telescope. The telescope launched from Earth Christmas Day in 2021 and has performed well beyond expectations since. Dr. Acton joins us today on Main Street to discuss his incredible history with the project and maybe tell us what's next for one of the most brilliant people I know. Scott, my friend, welcome to Main Street.
Well, it's good to be here, Craig.
Scott, before we look forward with the James Webb Space Telescope, let's look back a little bit. Tell us your background and how you became involved in the James Webb Space Telescope project.
When I was in second grade, my dad brought home a new television for us. The vertical hold adjustment on the old one was broken, and it was still a black and white TV, but he gave me the old television to take apart and just have fun with. I think he took the picture tube out so I wouldn't electrocute myself, but I just remember being completely enthralled by what I saw inside of that television. You know, back then, this is an old TV. Old television had gears and pulleys and mechanisms and
knobs.
Smells and knobs. And I was hooked from that moment on. As a little boy, I was defined by electronics. I kind of got the reputation of being the neighborhood mad scientist. And I didn't understand any of it, but I could build pretty much anything. It's like cooking. You have a recipe, you have ingredients, you follow the rules. Most of the time, it comes out right. And people would ask me what I was going to be when I grew up, and I said, well, I'll work with electronics, of course, but I had no idea what that meant, so I figured that I would be a TV repairman. I mean, that made sense. You know, a lot of the parts I got for my projects came from old disused televisions, and that was the vision that I had for myself, working for someone that owned a TV repair shop.
Like my dad
and,
did.
Yes, cow. Like your father. That's absolutely right. But then one day I had an experience that changed my life, and my uncle, who was a Methodist minister, was visiting, and we were on the floor of my parents' kitchen playing with a set of dominoes, and he asked me some questions. He said, you know, we weren't playing the game. We were, you know, stacking them up and knocking them down, and he said, what do you think would happen if we pushed these dominoes closer together? You think they'd fall down faster or slower? And we did these little experiments, and he said to me, that's physics, Scott. And I said, physics? What's that? And he said, physics, that's what a physicist does for a living. And I just remember thinking, you mean to tell me there's a job you can get where you do this stuff all day long and get paid for it? And from that moment on, I decided I would become a physicist. And, you know, one thing led to another. I ended up doing my summer jobs out of college at the Lockheed Missiles and Space Company in Palo Alto, California, and got involved with optics. And that led to working with some observatories. And that led to a six-year stay at the Keck Observatory. And that eventually led to JWST in Boulder, Colorado.
You started your career at a community college. You didn't go right out of the gate to MIT or anywhere like that.
That's right. Yes, I right out of high school, I went to Central Wyoming College primarily because, you know, they offered me a scholarship. I think it was maybe $1,500 or so, and it was a very good choice for me. I think a university would have just absolutely kicked my rear end in that moment. You know, usually it's not the intellectual things or the academic things that gives a student right out of high school a hard time. It's more of just handling life, and to be able to be there in a friendly environment and still be with my parents, it was absolutely crucial for me. I did find out after there that I couldn't major in physics. There was a teacher there that taught physics, but he said you have to transfer to a university. And so the next year I did. I went to the University of Wyoming. And from there, I ended up transferring to Texas, where I finished up my education. But Central Wyoming College was a very essential first step in my education.
And here comes now an opportunity. It wasn't yesterday. It wasn't last year. But it was a long time ago with this James Webb Space Telescope idea. How did that come into your life?
Well, I was living in Hawaii with my family and completed the work I went there to do. I spent 6 years working with the W.M. Keck Observatory. I built the adaptive optics systems for that, which was a really great opportunity and a fun experience for me. But I found myself asking, okay, what do I do next? I always say that I was born in a midlife crisis. I just always had this sense that I needed to accomplish and needed to do things. I've been very driven. And at the time, I thought the really neatest thing to do would be for humanity to put a person on Mars. And I looked around, and politically and economically and sociologically, the window for us to become a spacefaring civilization had closed. It really had. And I wasn't the only one that recognized this. I mean, everybody had. Now, I would say in hindsight that somehow Elon Musk and SpaceX has opened this window up. We are definitely going to go to Mars. But at that point back then, you know, 20 some odd years ago, that was an absolute impossibility. And so I decided that if I could make an impact on this new telescope, which they called back then the Next Generation Space Telescope, that if I could make a significant impact on that, that I would be able to look at the years that I spent on it and feel good about it. So I, in a speculative sense, I wasn't sure who was going to win that contract, but I picked up my family and we moved to Boulder, Colorado. And as it turned out, Ball Aerospace, working with what was TRW at the time, were awarded the contract. So I was in the right place. And spent the next 20 years working on this project.
Your role, Scott, was to take these 18 beautiful mirrors. And that number is correct, right? 18?
Yes.
That's in my mind. And once they unfolded, you didn't have anything to do with the launch or its travel there. But here we come now. The space telescope has cooled down. It's behind this massive umbrella, sunshade, if you will. And these mirrors start to unfold, and here comes you and your role. What did you do?
That's right. Well, basically what I did, and the team that I worked with, you know, credit where credit is due. I had a team of about 15 people who actually, you know, sat on the computer consoles 24 hours a day and clicked the buttons. But basically what we needed to do was take each of those 18 mirror segments and plus the secondary mirror too, which is sort of sits off away from the rest of the telescope, like, you know, like a normal telescope would. And we had to put those in exactly the right positions. And I'm not talking about millimeters or even microns. I'm talking nanometers, you know, a billionth of a meter.
And the size, Scott, of a virus? Is that an actual...
The virus is huge. Virus is huge.
Wow.
It is. Just imagine. I thought a really good analogy is if you pictured North America, you know, the United States as being the primary mirror, and then each of the states as being a mirror segment, the positions we're talking about are the size of an anthill. So it's very, very precise, and it has to be that way because the wavelength of light we're looking at is very, very small. We needed to be a very small fraction of the wavelength of light so that it makes a perfect image. And it sounds impossible, but it's not impossible at all as long as everything is stable. I mean, if you can move a mirror and have it affect the image you form, well, then there's got to be a way that you can look at that image and work out what's wrong and what needs to be fixed. And that's what I spent 20 years figuring out how to do.
And the hardware didn't exist to do that which you were trying to do. Is that right?
Yes, that's absolutely right. You know, we had some general ideas of how to proceed, but there were a number of different technologies on this telescope that had never been demonstrated. One was this deployable sun shield. Another is the micro shutter array, which is used with one of the instruments, which is a spectrograph. So we had to go through a series of steps to do something known as a technology readiness level demonstration. And so as far as my part, we built a scale model of the telescope in a clean room that was completely optical, completely functional in every way. Now, obviously, it wasn't in a vacuum and it wasn't, you know, in a cryogenic environment, but we then developed these algorithms and demonstrated them on this test bed to achieve something known as TRL-6, which means that it's been demonstrated in a flight-like environment. And once we got to that point, then we, you know, had enough confidence to proceed with the mission and with building the telescope and ultimately launching it.
Scott, when you are aligning these mirrors in near 0 degrees Kelvin, is that right? Am I getting that scientifically correct? Which is very cold. You can give us a better definition of what that means.
It's almost as cold as North Dakota. I mean, it's getting really close.
That's cold.
Okay.
However, did you use lasers? How were you getting feedback to Earth that you were successful? How did you know it was working? There had to be a moment when you weren't sure and then you were sure. How did all that come together?
It's very piecemeal. I mean, so the telescope is obviously designed to take images. And we have, you know, 7 different science modes. But one of them in particular, the near-infrared camera, which was built by the University of Arizona and the Lockheed Missiles and Space Company specifically for this mission, they send images down. So it was in the middle of the night on February 2nd. We pointed the telescope at a part of the sky known as the Large Magellanic Cloud, where there are lots and lots and lots of stars. So that no matter how far off you are, you're going to see something. And we took an image. And we got a big blob of images down because we get an image of the sky from every single segment because they're not looking at the same part of the sky. And from there, then we pointed the telescope over to a single star that was a very bright star and didn't have any other stars nearby. And then we rastered the telescope around, taking images, and then pieced them all together until we saw a picture of 18 individual stars, one for each of those mirror segments. And then we went through some steps where we like set the focus of the telescope and you could wiggle each of those segments and take an image before and after. So we figured out which spot in the image corresponded to which segment. And then it was just a question of tilting those segments to bring them all in so that we could perform the further analysis on this. Now, as this is done, we're getting images down every day, and we can analyze those to see how we're doing. But it's literally just pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. And eventually, we downloaded an image that was perfect and diffraction limited, and it showed that the telescope was completely aligned, one of the highest resolution images ever taken from space. And the very first image we brought down had 241 galaxies in it. One of those galaxies even showed an ongoing supernova. And when I saw those images for the first time and realized, I just realized that every image that this telescope is going to produce is going to look like the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. If you integrate long enough, you see a galaxy. There's no part of the sky that is dark. The dark sky is a myth. Everywhere you see is a galaxy. And so I suppose for me, when I saw that image with 241 galaxies in it, that's when I knew we were successful.
Where were you?
I was in we set it up a conference room. This is at Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, Maryland. But we set up a conference room and the data processing pipeline such that no human would see the image until we all got to see it. So there was no sneaking and looking at it beforehand. So we were all in this room and projecting the images as they came down onto a big screen. And my wife was there with me, which was really nice at the time she was visiting. And then we displayed this image on the screen, and it was just absolutely magnificent.
Everything that I have read about the James Webb Space Telescope, Scott, tells me that it is exceeding expectations. And I find that interesting because there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of fault points along the way, yet here we are with something that is performing beautifully and will last longer than we thought it would. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. It had a requirement to last for 5 years. We were predicting 10, but now it looks like it's probably going to last 20 years.
When we look at the images that come down, we're all struck with a sense of it's beautiful. It's just stunning. But I think for many people, that thought maybe ends right there, that, boy, that's just beautiful. But you think of it in a much different way, I presume. What do you see when you see these incredible images that we've come to love?
I always come back to the little rhyme that we would learn as kids, twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are. And we are attracted to the beauty of these images, the beauty of creation. And only then do we ask ourselves the question, why? why are we seeing what we're seeing? Why is it like that? But the initial reaction is one of emotion and one of beauty, of artistic expression. And that's the correct reaction. So I look at those beautiful pictures that everyone else is looking at, and I ask myself, why? And that's what all the astronomers are doing right now. Now, of course, the very first image I saw, which was on February 2nd in the middle of the night, was not a beautiful picture. It was an extremely aberrated image, and I began to ask myself why in a negative sense. And of course, because we need to align the optics. It all comes back. I mean, I love to talk about this subject, Craig. When we look at some of the, before cameras existed, some of the earliest drawings of galaxies that people didn't really know there were galaxies, they called them nebula. And one of them in particular, Lord Rosse, had a telescope that he built himself, and he drew these pictures of the Whirlpool Nebula, these spirals. And when I show this to adults, I say, what does this remind you of? Think 1800s. In general, the adults don't understand, but when I show it to little kids, invariably some little kid will stand up and say, oh, that's Starry Night from Vincent van Gogh. And Vincent van Gogh, I believe anyway, saw some of his drawings, and he was moved by the fact that there were these spiral things in the sky. And that's where he came up with his series of paintings. The most famous one is A Starry Night, that shows this very correct artistic expression of what we see scientifically. So it's hard to not want to bring art and spirituality into this, because they seem to be inseparable, at least from the standpoint of how we experience it as humans.
We're visiting with Dr. Scott Acton, a wavefront scientist for Ball Aerospace, talking about the James Webb Space Telescope. Scott, where does this triumph rank in human history relative to science?
Wow, ask me that in 100 years, and I bet you I could answer it.
What are you feeling today
better,
about it?
But it strikes me as the most important scientific endeavor that we've ever done. I believe it was probably outdone in terms of human hours by the Great Wall of China, but that's probably it. We 2,000 people worked for 25 years on this to make it happen, and it is literally changing the way we think about the universe. So I guess I would have to say this is probably, cautiously say this is probably the most important scientific advancement that humanity has taken.
Give us a sense, Scott. You talked about it briefly earlier. We also know a lot about the Hubble Space Telescope. Many of us know that it wasn't working quite right, and we hopped on a space shuttle, did a spacewalk, and we fixed it. That's not going to happen to this telescope, because it's much farther away. Where is it? Give us a sense of its hardware and what will happen next with it. Will it stay in the same spot? Is it in a normal orbit? Where is it?
Well, the telescope is at a magical place called L2, the second Lagrangian point between the Earth-Sun system. So it was kind of a dilemma. I mean, you can't put a telescope just in a low Earth orbit, because just the heat from the Earth would warm it up. Remember, this telescope has to be cold. I mean, very cold in order to work. So we put it at a point that's a million miles away from the Earth, but it's a magical point in that it tends to stay there. So if you draw a line between the Sun and the Earth and then go out a million miles further, there is this magical point, which is called the second Lagrangian point, where you can keep a body stationary there with very little effort. So what will happen is we will continue to update its position by firing thrusters until the spacecraft runs out of fuel, in which case it'll eventually drift away and become lost. That's predicted to happen in 20 years. So we've got 20 years of time to do science on this.
Who decides what science is done on the James Webb Space Telescope?
A committee. Uh-huh. A committee that was formed, and anyone can submit a proposal. Even you and I could. And they're evaluated on a handful of things, the scientific merit, how appropriate it is for the instrumentation we have, and determined way in advance, and then it's all scheduled. One of the neat things about this is that if you're the astronomer or the scientist that's leading a particular investigation, you get exclusive rights to those images for 6 months. And then it becomes available to anyone in the world who wants to look at them. And even now, like all the wavefront sensing data that I looked at in aligning the telescope, anybody can download those images and have them.
Is this telescope designed to tell us whether life exists elsewhere, to tell us more about the beginning of the of our existence in the universe, or something else?
Well, I mean, certainly the life thing is a big question, right? And this telescope could certainly tell us if there are atmospheric conditions on a planet near that's orbiting a nearby star that might be favorable for life to exist. It of course doesn't answer that question, until they stand up and wave at you. You don't really know. Quite honestly, the simplest way for us to find out how common life is in the universe is to go to Mars and to see if we can find evidence of fossilized life there. If we don't, that says an awful lot, because Mars had conditions that were suitable for life in the past. And, on the other hand, we may find it. We may find, viruses or bacteria or who knows what. What we're going to have to look for in these other planets are signatures for carbon dioxide, for, even methane in an atmosphere of a nearby planet. And that won't definitively answer it, but it'll come close. The telescope that's to come after this one, you may have heard it called the LUVOIR or whatever, will have something known as a coronagraph that can take detailed spectra on planets that are orbiting nearby stars and might actually say, look for something like chlorophyll or something, So I am afraid we're probably not going to answer that particular question with the Webb telescope unless we get very, very lucky. Now, as far as the origins, absolutely. It's already caused us to completely rethink how the early galaxies were formed and evolved. We knew there'd be surprises. Okay, so if the images coming back were mundane, that would be a tremendous surprise, but they're not. They're showing pictures of galaxies that were around only 200 million years after the universe began that are fully mature galaxies. They look like ours. They have stars in them that have lived and died, and elements that have been formed that can only happen after a supernova. Neon is one that was surprising to see in these early galaxies, oxygen. And so now we've got to completely go back and try to understand how the first stars were formed and the life cycle of these early galaxies.
We're visiting with Dr. Scott Acton of Ball Aerospace. We're going to be right back and visit more with Scott after this news break.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A House committee is considering a bill that would end the trigger on oil taxes. Under that mechanism, the oil tax would go from 10 to 11% if the price per barrel gets high enough. The trigger took effect in 2022 for several months. North Dakota Petroleum Council President Ron Ness told the House Finance and Tax Committee removing the trigger would create certainty in the oil industry. He said when the trigger took effect in 2022, it was a drag on the industry.
Just when Wall Street and the financial markets were ready to reinvest in oil exploration and get producers back on their feet, North Dakota's version of the windfall profits tax kicked in, and the oil extraction tax on North Dakota production was increased by 20% overnight. The Bakken has rebounded well, but we did not see the big bounce from $100 oil that we usually would be expected with such a strong price point. That could be the result of numerous issues, but increasing the tax rate certainly was not helpful and hard to explain back to my producers to say, oh, by the way, North Dakota's tax rate just went up 20% yesterday. Good for you.
The only opposition came from Bismarck attorney Fenton Dooley, who said more money is needed to reclaim non-producing and abandoned wells. The committee did not take immediate action. The Education and Environment Subcommittee of House Appropriations is endorsing an amendment to the higher education budget bill that freezes tuition at the state's 11 public colleges and universities. Instead, the state will pick up what would have amounted to a 4% annual tuition increase for the upcoming 2 years. The cost is $47 million. Bismarck Republican Representative Mike Nathy chairs that subcommittee.
I think it's a great message to send to our kids, to the parents and the students. We find ourselves in a financial situation where we can do this. We just got to make sure we do it correctly and it doesn't come back to bite us.
A modest tuition increase would be allowed for high-cost programs on the campuses. The full Appropriations Committee will look at the amendment later. And a bill that would prohibit vaccine mandates in North Dakota was presented to the House Human Services Committee. Representative Scott Lauser of Minot says the bill would enact a vaccine prohibition unless the legislature were to act and make a vaccine a part of the Century Code.
It would be a Class C felony, which is a $10,000 fine or up to 5 years. If a business or an entity were to impose a vaccine mandate on anybody in North Dakota.
A number of residents testified in favor of the bill, saying that it would give North Dakotans bodily autonomy as well as help with the nursing shortage in the state. Opponents of the bill, such as State Health Officer Dr. Nazir Wiebe, were concerned that since the bill prohibits all vaccination mandates, regardless of setting and type, vaccinations for vaccine-preventable diseases will drop. The committee took no further action at this time. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we're visiting with Dr. Scott Acton. He's a wavefront scientist with Ball Aerospace, talking about the James Webb Space Telescope. Scott, you embarked on a bicycle ride around the world to promote the James Webb Space Telescope. Tell me about that.
Yes, it's something I've always wanted to do. I've always felt like you know, that if you want to call it as your purpose or whatever, that I was meant to bicycle around the world. And it's not something that happens automatically. In fact, there are all manner of things in life designed to keep a person from doing that. You know, children, mortgages, that sort of thing.
Wind and cold.
But I found myself, the cold, that's right. I found myself in a unique situation. I could sort of afford to take a year off from my job. The project could have me take a year off. My children were all off going to college. And although I was in my mid-50s, my body hadn't figured it out yet. And so I was still in pretty good physical shape. And so I decided to take this opportunity to do this bike ride. And I'd done a lot of bicycle touring before, and I find that some people can relate to the idea of why a person would want to go on a long journey by bicycle, but most people don't. So what do? We try to associate the ride with something else, like world peace. Well, world peace was already taken, so I decided to associate the ride with large space-based telescopes, namely the James Webb Space Telescope. So this became the James Webb Space Telescope World Bicycle Tour. Some people in NASA thought that was really, really great. Other people at NASA were horrified by the idea that I would do this and somehow link my personal activities to this telescope. But of course, that's all public domain. You know, there's nothing to prevent a person from doing that. And I set off to do this ride. I presume you want me to talk a little bit about some of the speed bumps that hit along the way, Craig.
But not necessarily, Scott. I just find it fascinating. But you were literally able to bicycle on several continents. You paused along the way to give talks. How did people receive you, I think, would be what I would want to know.
Yeah, it was interesting. In general, the reception was quite positive. As I went further north in North America, I would say the reception was colder. but, you know, just people tend to be more reserved, a little less friendly as you get further north. As I got to Eastern Europe, I noticed the same thing, too. They tend to be a little more reserved, a little more cautious about some weirdo showing up in a brightly colored bicycle outfit. But people everywhere were just absolutely thrilled with the fact that this was happening. Most people had never heard of the telescope, and science is not for everybody, but everybody loves technology. And so the technology of this telescope was what I concentrated on in the lectures, and in particular the kids, the children were really, really excited by it.
Scott, what is next for you? And I ask that in all seriousness with the thought that you reached a pinnacle in your career when so much effort and focus of your life came together in that one moment you knew everything was going to work. And maybe you exhaled, maybe you didn't, but now what's next?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I hope I don't offend anybody by using this example, but, you know, back when you and I were going to college as freshmen, you walk into a classroom, you look around, and what do? Of course, you find the prettiest girl in there and you sit down next to her. Okay, And I think that's a reasonable way to approach it. So I have, in my view, the most exciting work that is taking place on our planet is what SpaceX is doing with its attempts to put a rocket on Mars. And so I've made, some efforts to get involved with this. I think the timing might be a little bad right now. I still think they'll, because I don't actually know how to build rockets. So if I had an opportunity to do that, that's what I would do. There are a lot of other very interesting things happening right now in the area. If I can avoid moving to Los Angeles, I will. I'll certainly do that. But that does seem to be where the really interesting stuff is taking place. And who knows? The world record for the oldest person to bicycle around the world is 56.
Well, you're 1 year past that, Scott. You can do it now.
Oh, I'm way more than 1 year past it.
Of course we are.
Scott. I could have done it on a unicycle at 56. So.
Scott, one of the most interesting things I've ever heard you say, we had a teacher in common in high school. Her name was Lois Sackman, and she was our speech and debate teacher. And I think it may surprise people to learn the value that you place on our speech class.
Yes. Yes. People assume that I would take, my math or my science background. But the reality is when you choose to major in something, your first day of class, you're going to far exceed what you learned in junior high and high school in that topic. And the ability to stand in front of people and talk, to express myself and communicate is the most important thing I learned in high school. I think the second most important thing I learned in high school was the ability to just socialize and interact with people, which I learned in band. I would say band, sitting next to our mutual friend Steve, all those years was perhaps the most formative thing that I experienced in all my education. Communication and socialization, that's what you have to come away with in high school.
Dr. Scott Acton, your work on the James Webb Space Telescope is just amazing. It's just wonderful for you to recount the stories again to me. I hope someday we can sit next to one another at a solar eclipse, Scott, and enjoy that again.
That would be fun.
Dr. Scott Acton, a wavefront scientist with Ball Aerospace. Scott, thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Well, you're welcome, Craig.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor with Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate Alliance Group in Bismarck, specializing in VA loans, home valuations, and commercial properties. Bill can be reached at BillDeanHomes.com. And by Touchmark at Harwood Groves Fargo and on West Century in Bismarck. Touchmark offers maintenance-free living so residents have more time to enjoy what they love. Fresh prepared meals, health and fitness club, and a full calendar of events with friends nearby. Learn more at touchmark.com.
This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Dr. Larry Napoleon sat down with John Harris on a Prairie Pulse and talked about the history of Black History Month and the thought behind this year's theme of Black Resistance.
Dr. Napoleon, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, you're here today to talk about Black History Month, but before we do that, tell the folks a little bit about yourself and maybe your background.
My background, I would say, personally, I'm a proud native son of New Orleans, Louisiana, son of a hardworking blue-collar dad and a devoted, loving mother and a nurturing older sister. And I think that those things were very important to shaping me. Academically, I am a graduate of two HBCUs in New Orleans, Dillard University, where I have a bachelor's degree in history, Xavier University, where I have a master's degree in curriculum and instruction, taught in the New Orleans public school system for 5 years before moving to Pennsylvania, where I earned a doctorate degree in curriculum and instruction from Penn State University. Following that, fate led me here to NDSU in Fargo, and I've been here for 14 years now.
Let's turn to what you do and things you've done. I understand you've organized and moderated a number of panels in our area dealing with race issues. Can you talk about some of that?
Yeah, so I've organized a few. I've been a part of many. right? Whether that be through campus, lots of different initiatives that focus on Black history or racism, things of that nature. And then I've had the esteemed honor of speaking at Juneteenth events for the past couple years. I've spoken at Fargo Film Festival, and it's just been a wonderful opportunity to be here and to offer my insight and talent to an issue that is definitely one that's plagued us in our society, historically and in a contemporary sense.
You're here today to talk a little bit about Black History Month. Yep. So can you say, you know, what is it and how and when was it founded? Tell us about it.
Yeah, so Black History Month has its roots. Well, first of all, I'll honor the father of Black History Month, and that's Dr. Carter G. Woodson. So Dr. Woodson was an author, a journalist, but most notably and perhaps most importantly, he was a historian. He was completely dedicated to researching, promoting, and disseminating information regarding the achievements and contributions of African Americans, right? 1915, Dr. Carter co-founded an organization that really poured resources into that effort, conducting research on all the contributions and achievements of African Americans. I believe about 11 years later, it was 1926, was the first, what was called then, Negro History Week. He chose the second week of February because that week aligned with the birthdays of Abraham Lincoln and the great Frederick Douglass. Abraham Lincoln's birthday is February 12th. Frederick Douglass's birthday is February 14th. Or his adopted birthday. He didn't know his exact birthday, but he adopted February 14th because his mother called him her little Valentine. So because of that, and honoring those people, the second week of February was chosen for Negro History Week. That went on until, gosh, about five decades roughly. And in 1970, an initiative to expand Negro History Week to Black History Month was pushed forth. And about 6 years later was the first time Black History Month was acknowledged by a sitting president. So it's been since 76 that we have a formally recognized Black History Month in the United States.
Is there a theme this year? I understand there seems to be a theme every year.
Yes, there's a theme every year. This year's theme is Black Resistance.
And what does that mean? What will happen with that theme, do you think?
Yeah, so I think with Black Resistance, in honoring there, in the historical tradition of African-American struggle, right? Since 1619, right, when slaves began to arrive on the shore, Africans began to arrive on the shores of the United States, and even actually before then, right, even boarding those vessels over here, there was always resistance, right? There's been resistance at every level of life and in every decade, every iteration of the Black struggle here in the United States. Resistance has been central to our progress and to our thriving. So you couldn't find a more fitting theme than Black Resistance, because even as we sit here now in 2023, resistance is still very much a part of our stories and a part of our daily lives.
How many countries observe Black History Month?
Well, I don't know exactly how many. I know for certain I can think of roughly up to a dozen different countries that celebrate either Black History Month, or some would celebrate what's called a Black History Day, right? But countries as diverse as the United Kingdom, Ireland, Italy, Germany, the Netherlands, Brazil, right? So it's a pretty diverse set of countries that celebrate Black history.
Did it start with the United States, or do
yes.
you know?
Yeah. Yes, yeah, it did. So basically, all these other iterations of a Black History Month are all descendants of the brainchild and the hard work of Dr. Carter G. Woodson. And it's not uncommon, right, that if you have a group of people anywhere who feel like they are not being represented, not being acknowledged, and you get a representation or you get an example of another set of people who have made that cause a reality, you think, you know what, we need to get some of that going over here as well. So these other Black History Month celebrations have all, I would say, go back to maybe starting in the 80s, and then there are some as recent as about 5 years ago or so, right? So, again, this goes back to the work of Carter G. Woodson, back to 1926, then that being broadened out in 1976. And about a decade or so later, you start to see Black folks in other countries you know, saying, hey, we've made contributions here as well, and they should be acknowledged. Because oftentimes they're not acknowledged in the traditional curriculum in schools and acknowledged in society in general. So we need to bring that to the fore.
Is there a website folks can learn all about the activities going on nationally during Black History Month?
Yeah, so I don't know if there is one repository, if you will, but the beautiful thing about 2023 is that you can just go to a search engine, type in Black History Month events, and you'll find an array of websites that will give you information about events here and there.
So how about in Fargo-Moorhead area, and can you talk about the observances and maybe different programs that are planned that you know of?
So locally, I think one place to check would be, I believe it's called fargoevents.com, and it'll give you a rundown on all local events there. If you're speaking about NDSU specifically, there you can go to the website of the Office of Multicultural Programs, and there is currently it's uploaded a listing of all of the events that are happening at NDSU. There are several.
Can you talk about any of those observances that you might be involved in? Or
so one that's been a really great event. I think I would imagine this event has been happening now close to a decade now, I think. It's called EFREAK, and it is sponsored by the Black Student Association at NDSU. And it is a great celebration of Black history across the entire diaspora. It's put on by the students. They run it. They perform songs, poetry, speeches. It's a really wonderful event. And I think that's one of my favorite events that happens at NDSU.
What are your thoughts about race relations in Fargo-Moorhead and, for that matter, in North Dakota? You've been here 14 years
now. Been here 14 years. So it's interesting you mentioned that, because within that 14 years, it's given me the opportunity to really watch a city and a community grow. If I were to think back to when we first moved here, again, 2009, I don't think there was lots of diversity represented in the community. One of the places I got to really watch this happen was in the schools. I spent lots of time out in the schools in Fargo, West Fargo, and to a lesser degree, Moorhead. I can even speak to this as a parent. When my oldest son, who is 17 years old now, and he's a junior in high school, when he began kindergarten, I remember in his class, he was one of two, if I'm not mistaken, two Black kids, and that was it, right? Schools were not very diverse then. Fast forward just a couple of years, and if you want to see the influx of diversity in Fargo, spend some time looking at the schools, and you can see it like plain as day, right? So the influx of diversity is happening. With regard to how all that's working out in the community, I think I'd say a couple of things. First of all, I'd say in my experience, I can only speak to my personal experience, in my experience, Fargo has been a welcoming place. But to determine how truly inclusive the community will be, I think there's a to be determined there. What I mean by that is we now have, through these kids who have moved here with parents and they're flooding the school systems, in about a decade or so, these kids are now going to be adults, right? How welcomed are they going to be in the workplace, right? Is there going to be a diverse representation of individuals in Fargo's community across the workforce, right? That would be, for me, a great telltale sign about just how, quote-unquote, race relations have developed in Fargo.
I understand you've talked a lot about maybe affirmative action in the past. Yep. And the Supreme Court might be taking a look at that. Can you talk about what is affirmative action and why was it first implemented?
Affirmative action has its roots in federal policy. In fact, the first time the term affirmative action was used, I believe it would be 1961, in an executive order from John F. Kennedy, where he spoke about using affirmative action in making sure hiring practices were non-discriminatory and that people would not be boxed out of opportunities based upon the language, I believe, was race, creed, color, or national origin. All right. Fast forward a couple years, I believe 1965, and Lyndon B. Johnson initiated another executive order, and I believe religion and and sex was added, and then gender followed soon thereafter in about 1968. So those are the roots of affirmative action. And the idea, again, was simply to try to ensure that hiring practices were non-discriminatory in our society.
What would be the consequences if the Supreme Court overturned the premise of affirmative action?
I think, sadly, one of the impacts may be a less with regard to what they're looking at, right? They're looking at affirmative action as a consideration for higher education admission specifically. And I think one of the potential impacts could be a less diverse school population in higher education, which would be unfortunate.
This is maybe a tough question here. What do you think's been learned since the George Floyd's death in 2020? And you look at what's going on in Memphis right now, and in terms of how things are changing in the United States?
Sadly, I think exactly what's happening right now in Memphis calls into question what we've learned, if anything, right? You know, if we were to contextualize this and look at this specific issue of police brutality and as it relates to African Americans, this is nothing new. So we're looking at circumstance in Memphis, Tennessee, where a man was brutally beaten to death. But you started the question with George Floyd, which was 2020. And I could rattle off name after name after name, right? If I were to go back 30 years or so, and we could talk about Rodney King or, right? So, and if I were to fast forward to the 70s, I'm pretty sure if I were to talk to my elders, they would rattle off names then. This is a deeply rooted issue in our country. And the truth, the sad truth of the matter is, I'm not sure what we've learned, if anything, because it continues to repeat itself over and over and over again.
What would Martin Luther King, Malcolm X think about today if they were still alive?
That's a heavy weight to assume the thoughts and position that MLK and Malcolm X would have. But I would say this, based upon their work, a couple different perspectives here. In one light, I think they might be encouraged by some of the progress that has been made within the African-American experience. But I would also say that largely they would be disappointed and I'm sure frustrated by the fact that some of the issues, many of the issues, quite frankly, that they were dealing with in 1950, 1960, they were both killed before 1970. But the issues that they died still wrestling with, we're still dealing with those things now. So, but I think they will be encouraged by the resilience that African Americans and other Americans of good faith are showing. There would absolutely be frustration and disappointment there as well.
Real quick, what would you want folks to know about Black History Month they might not know?
Well, I think what I would like people to know is, to paraphrase Dr. Carter G. Woodson, he said the emphasis should not be on Negro History Week, but on Negroes in history. In other words, this is just a part of the historical narrative of this society, right? And while we have this moment to highlight those contributions, there should really be a push and an emphasis to be inclusive of the contributions and achievements of African Americans in the larger American historical narrative.
So if people want more information, maybe you've already suggested, where's the best place to go?
Yeah, so in 2023, the best place to go is pull out your phone, get on that laptop, and we can easily do research, all of us, from anywhere at any time, and that's the beauty of 2023.
Well, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's John Harris with Dr. Larry Napoleon, who earned his PhD in education from Pennsylvania State University and is currently an associate professor at the North Dakota State University School of Education. Dakota Datebook is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public. Today's Dakota Datebook is part of an ongoing weekly series produced in partnership with the Department of Public Instruction on Indigenous Peoples themes.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 7 is about Native identity. It states, individual and communal identity is defined and supported by shared Native languages, kinship systems, teoshpae, clan structures, traditional teachings, values, sacred laws, and ceremonies. A continuum of tribal identity, unique to each individual, ranges from assimilated to traditional lifestyle. There is no generic American Indian. In this episode of Dakota Datebook,
We'll hear Aya Konape Tushunka Fox, an indigenous dancer, young father, and an enrolled member of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation, share how he honors his young son's identity through immersing him in his family's generational cultural practices while allowing his individuality to inform his ultimate course.
It would be awesome to see him dance. I mean, he has his stuff, he has everything, but if that day decides to come where he's going to be like, Dad, you know, I like chess, or I like doing this stuff, or, you know, he has more attention to basketball like his uncle, I'm going to go with him. You know, I'm going to push him what he's interested in. But, you know, I'm pretty positive, though, that he's into this, because, you know, he has the beat, he has the rhythm. You know, I mean, I'll be getting ready for the day, and, you know, I'll be like, oh, shoot, this new album came out, and I'll be listening to new songs, studying the new songs, and sure enough, you know, I'll hear his foot kicking while we're driving and hitting on time, and, you know, some parents will be like, don't be kicking my seat and stuff like that, but here I am, be like, all right, Nate, well, I'll change the song up on him, and, you know, sure enough, he'll be kicking the feet, kicking my seat to the car hop, and it's pretty amazing. But as I said, for my hopes for my son, I'll help him, you know, just like my dad did, you know, I'll help whatever he wants to do in his life. I'll push him and stuff like that. I'm not going to push anything on him. You know, if he's interested, he'll talk about the hoop dancing. You know, we'll give him the hoops after my time comes. I mean, that's a while, but... but...
I'm Scott Simpson. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. Tomorrow, Darren Langrud, the director of the North Dakota Atmospheric Resources Board, stops by. His board has oversights over the state's cloud seeding programs. What is cloud seeding? What's weather modification? He'll have those answers. Also, 529 plans are used for college savings. Starting next year, people will have the opportunity to roll over unused funds into Roth IRAs penalty-free. We'll talk with Bell Investment Wealth Advisor Nicholas Peterson about what parents and college students need to know. And today is the last day to make a donation to Prairie Public and get boxes of cocoa truffles sent to anyone, anywhere in the continental United States in time for Valentine's Day. Just go to prairiepublic.org to get those truffle orders in before midnight tonight. Remember, you can hear all episodes of Main Street on our website at prairiepublic.org. Thanks for joining us, and enjoy the rest of your day.